Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Wednesday, the 12th of November, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. A joy to have you with us, and we just thank you. And we also welcome you to be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have a lot to discuss, a lot to talk about, and we have a great group to do that with this morning. So let me introduce them. All kinds of new stuff breaking, so we have added stories and all of that stuff. So here we go. Senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pendicio, joins us. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Joe. How are you today?
I'm well.
Good. Good. Enjoying this winter weather?
It may not seem it at first glance, but I'm fine.
Good. Good. I am as well. I'm looking forward this weekend. I'm going to travel out to Buffalo, New York for no other reason than to see my Bills, but I'm very nervous. They're underperforming this year.
This last game was
Can we not talk about that?
Yeah. No, I don't want to talk about it either. Okay. It was dismal, and that's a shame.
Dismal is a very appropriate
If it wasn't Miami, come on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You got to beat up on bad teams.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I wish you well. I think you'll have a great time. Is it a day game, night game?
It is a day game. I plan to have a good time, win or lose, but man, it's a long drive home after a loss.
Yes. I've had that ride. That's a long ride. We also welcome Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel joins us. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Glad to be able to join the discussion this morning.
Very nice to have you here as always, and glad that we could make it work today. We also welcome investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. I'm a little bit disappointed there are already flurries in the air. I have to finish winterizing my garden, but I'm pretty close.
Yeah.
Now, down where you live, or down where you all live, I guess, was there any measurable snow?
No, nothing measurable. But if you squinted and tilted your head, you could see the flurries.
Because when I left here Monday afternoon, and we did not work yesterday because of the holiday, and then I came back, it had been snowing that entire time from, like sticking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not really accumulating because it's just that warm, but it is accumulating, but not as to the rate of which it is snowing.
It's coming.
I'm going to Lake Placid next week, so I guess I better switch out to my snow tires. Huh?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Well, but I will say, absolutely, I'll do the North Country thing, but it's so pretty.
It is pretty.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous.
My view is, if we're going to have cold, give me the snow, because there's nothing more depressing than these long gray winters that we have on bare ground.
I agree with you. And I think, and just over the past 3 days, it's just cool, because it almost seems like lake effect snow, where just, you know, if you're out in the Rochester or Buffalo areas, it just snows and snows and snows and snows and snows. And it was sort of like that. I like that. That's kind of cool. All right. Good morning, all. Let's go to what is making news this morning. And I guess the big story that broke just a bit ago is the Epstein story. And I think I have said this on a fair number of occasions. As we go into these stories, that I always do these stories, Epstein stories, somewhat under protest. I think it's people expect us to talk about it, want us to talk about it. I haven't quite figured out why exactly it's a story yet, but I mean, I know it's a story. Don't get me wrong, but I just like. We know that there was a connection between the two, right? So what more do we need to know? I guess, is my question. So today, Epstein alleged in emails that Trump knew of his conduct. In a message obtained by Congress, the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein wrote that Donald Trump spent hours at his house with one of Mr. Epstein's victims. Mr. Trump has emphatically denied any involvement in or knowledge of Mr. Epstein's sex trafficking operation. He has said that he and Mr. Epstein, the disgrace financier who died by suicide in federal prison, were once friendly but had a falling out. But Democrats in the House Oversight Committee said the emails, which they selected from thousands of pages of documents received by their panel, raised new questions about the relationship between the two men. In one of the messages, Mr. Epstein flatly asserted that Mr. Trump knew about the girls, many of whom were later found by investigators to have been underage. In another, Mr. Epstein pondered how to address the questions from the news media about the relationship as Mr. Trump was becoming a national political figure. The White House did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The messages are certain to inflame the debate on Capitol Hill over the Trump administration's handling of the so-called Epstein files and top officials' decisions to backtrack on a promise to fully release them. That issue, which has split Republicans and alienated some of Mr. Trump's right-wing supporters, had faded to the background as the government shutdown dragged on. Shutdown's over. House is set to return today to clear legislation to end the shutdown. And now the attention is likely to shift back to the Epstein matter. That from the New York Times. Karen Riedel, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I actually, there is a clear connection between the Epstein scandal and the shutdown, which I'm sure we're going to talk more about. But let's not forget about one silver lining about the end of the shutdown, and that is that Johnson will have to swear in the Democrat from Arizona. And I'm probably going to butcher her name, and I apologize in advance, but Alida Grijalva, who will be the final signer on the discharge petition that will force the House vote on releasing the Epstein files. So there's of course, a connection between today's story on Epstein and the end of the shutdown.
Mark.
Well, Joe, I agree with your reluctance to discuss this. If you want to protect children, we could talk about Gaza, we could talk about Sudan, we could talk about SNAP benefits or what's been wrought in Venezuela. Although I will consent to the fact that the victims have made a great case for their continuing search for justice. And I must say, at first I thought, well, wait a second. These files were all sitting in the Justice Department when Merrick Garland and the Democrats were in charge. So I presume anything that could have been done legally has been done. I also, frankly, if you want to know who Donald Trump is, listen to his interview with Howard Stern. Nothing that you could dream of in the Epstein files should surprise you once you already know who Donald Trump is. But I think there's a couple factors I probably missed. Number one is I do think we've reached peak Donald Trump, and I think Donald Trump realizes that he's got less clothing on than the public is aware of, and he's trying to keep that image, the false image, in the public's head. I also think you keep walking by these Epstein files, and you see what happened with Ghislaine Maxwell, and there's a stench in the garbage can. I mean, it is clear that something is going on. Why else does the Todd Blanche, Ghislaine Maxwell get sent to comfy prison transaction happen? Why else does a president of the United States, when he's asked, well, could you pardon her, basically use the same preamble that he's used with other people who he eventually did pardon? Well, I don't know. Haven't thought about it. I guess I could. I mean, that should be the easiest question on the planet. Would you ever pardon one of the, if not the most notorious child molesters still living in America? The United States president should have a simple, one-word, emphatic answer to that. So this isn't where I spend my time. I guess we probably do owe the victims here more transparency than they've gotten thus far. That's clearly the case. And I wouldn't be surprised. I would anybody who wonders what's in the Epstein files, just listen to the Howard Stern interview of Donald Trump. Nothing should surprise you, but I think we've learned that the public sometimes is in the midst of a cognitive dissonance, and it would seize the truth, as it did with Donald Trump and the denial of SNAP benefits. It actually does sometimes capitulate when it's forced to change their views of the man, and maybe we'll see more of that.
Robert.
Well, first, thanks, Mark, for putting that image into my cerebral cortex of Donald Trump having no clothes. I will not be able to unsee that for the rest of the day. Thanks very much for that. Look, Joe, more earnestly, I kind of share your distaste for this story. And we're going to discuss it because powerful people are discussing it. The issue for me is, why are powerful people discussing it? And, you know, obviously I'm not blithe about, child welfare. I was a former public school teacher. But, you know, what's the end game here? This is political leverage seeking at the end of the day. One owes the victims justice. I'm all for transparency. So, you know, Mark, your point's an excellent one. We've been sitting on these files under two administrations now. So I hope this doesn't sound cynical, but if there were smoking guns in those files, we would have heard about them by now, right? One assumes. So I'm not sure what we're going to learn when all is said and done, but we will continue to talk about it. There will be hearings. There will be political leverage seeking. And my fearless prediction is this is not the last time we will be talking about this on the roundtable.
If I may, I actually think the question to if there were smoking guns, we've heard about it. I presumed that was the case until I haven't read the book, but I've heard reports of what the Merrick Garland Justice Department was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's as much of a victim of active cognitive dissonance as many of Trump's supporters. He tried to look the other way and said, I don't want to get involved in all this because it'll be seen as too political. He certainly did that with respect to Donald Trump's alleged crimes around January 6th. And it wouldn't surprise me if he and the Justice Department did that with respect to the Epstein file.
So
the question of should we know, we would know by now, the answer is maybe not. The question of leaks is to say that leaking is to suggest that leaking is a perfect substitute for releasing all the information, which we all know it's not. So I don't think we should pretend that leaks will solve transparency problems. Oh, I don't think we should rely on that on behalf of the victims either. That's not fair.
No, I'm not suggesting that leaks are the answer to transparency, but just given the political motivations of those trying to, you know, stop or thwart Donald Trump for a decade now, if someone in the Justice Department had access to a smoking gun in the Epstein files, it just strains my credulity that we would not have heard.
I think that flies in the face of what we've actually seen.
Okay.
If that card that Donald Trump allegedly wrote.
Yes.
Presumably there were people who had motivations to have that released a long time ago, and for whatever set of reasons, it didn't get out there. So again, to say that, well, hey, we shouldn't really look at something and release all the files because this dubious practice of leaking would have solved it for us is to abrogate
that.
Our responsibility
here. Let me be clear. I'm not saying that at all. I'm all for releasing the files. If nothing else, just to get it all out. This is the people's business. Let us see what's in the files. But my point is this feels like this is an exercise in political leverage seeking as opposed to justice seeking.
I don't doubt there's political leverage seeking as part of this, but that shouldn't negate the need for transparency.
I agree.
And we talk about this, and I think I'm on the right track here. But if I'm not, please slap me into shape. But it just seems to me that we often say, "Well, look, this is just if Trump does something. This is just to get everybody's mind off the Epstein files, and he's done this, and we're going here, and we're bombing this, and we're doing this. Well, okay, they are just to get us our attention away from the Epstein files." So now the Democrats, and your view may vary, but they completely botched the shutdown.
I didn't say it.
Return, and then this morning, as the House is ready to vote, outcome House Democrats release these files as if to manipulate the American public to suddenly say, now this should be on your radar screen.
You said it, Joe. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah, the one thing I would say, Joe, is there are those of us, and we have the receipts, who claim that the Democrats botched this when they didn't fold initially. They had a lousy hand and they tried to play it, which, if you remember, I said Schumer should have walked away at the beginning. So the mistake in my book wasn't the return. I get that this is being used politically. That doesn't escape me. But it also doesn't escape me that the Yockham's razor explanation for what's going on with Todd Blanche and Ghislaine Maxwell suggests that there's a lot there that will buttress at least my view of who Donald Trump is.
Karen, anything you'd like to add?
No, I'm listening intently and to the arguments on the different sides. I think very interesting.
You know, it's one of those stories, and I think my reluctance comes and has been. Today I felt every major news organization is leading with it. I felt that we should too, just because it is something that is new, I guess. But again, I keep going back to Mark's excellent point about the Howard Stern interview, and not just that, but whether it be the Access Hollywood tape or the reports from the beauty pageants or from the fact, you know, that he went to court over the hush money to a porn star. I mean, it's like, again, so what are you going to come up with? Now, if you can prove that Donald Trump trafficked and had sex with an underage child, well, yes, okay, but that's not what we're talking about here. The allegation here is that the two men were closer than was initially reported, which I think. Yeah. None of us really believed anyway because we saw all the pictures.
Right. And Mark's point's a very good one. I mean, there are no mysteries about Donald Trump's character, but he was elected twice despite people knowing that. So what is, again, the end game here? Is it to surface criminality? Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, I do think there's an active cognitive dissonance in the mind of many who support or at least tolerate Donald Trump. That may well be shattered if there's more evidence.
Just like last time.
We will be back and continue this conversation after this short break. I'm not asking you to say. It's as if we planned this, but Robert just said, who is this playing? And I will tell you, too. It's Michael McDermott playing Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs, New York, tomorrow at 7 p.m. You can find out more by going to cafelena.org. Cafe spelled with two F's in this case, cafelena.org, and the playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. Let's see. Michael says, sad that this morning's discussion of the Epstein file development sounds like expression of a desire to make it all seem irrelevant and meaningless. When will we stop being apologists for Donald Trump and his behavior? The let bygones be bygones and leave it all buried tone of your discussion is nauseating. Well, this is yet another example.
Did we say anything like that?
Well, this is another example of why I don't like this story.
Okay.
I think there's a nuance there. No, I think that it is... it's not at all to seem that it's irrelevant. It's just that it becomes irrelevant because it is played for, I guess, a political gotcha. But is there anything new and damning that comes to it? And there is that child who cried wolf scenario here, where if you keep saying, well, we have these documents that show this. Okay, but what didn't we know already was all my point. I'm saying, and that's it. I'm not apologizing for Donald Trump. I certainly think we've put that on the record over the years, by the way, and not let bygones be bygones. But do you have something that is Mark and I were talking during the break about this, and Mark said you use the term black hole. And that you're sort of circling it, and I agree with you, but it to that point, you know, I just don't know what exactly we're going for here.
Okay, look, I heard the Access Hollywood tape, and that I challenge anybody to go read the transcript of the defamation case regarding sexual assault that Trump was involved in. And then go listen to the Howard Stern interview and figure out what Trump may or may not have done with respect to Epstein. I think it's pretty clear. But Joe, I go back to the voter that the Washington Post interviewed just before the election who said, I know who Donald Trump is, I know he's a bad guy, but I need to send my kid to college and the economy really stinks. There is a 20 to 30% of America that has a active cognitive dissonance in terms of holding their nose. And the one thing that I, with respect to Donald Trump, who he probably truly is and what his conduct probably truly has been historically. And I do believe that the black hole of child rape is strong enough that once he no longer has the force to circle around the event horizon like he has historically, that black hole may draw him in and may lead to a degradation of the public's view of him that no other situation could. And to the point, I point to this. During the shutdown, Donald Trump handed the Democrats a strong hand when he stood center stage in a black hat and a black cape, twisted the handlebars on his mustache, and literally, well, figuratively, sued to not feed poor people in America. I mean, let me just say that again. The president of the United States actively tried not to feed the most vulnerable in our nation. And if you look at what happened to his popularity once he started that game, there was a measurable degradation. I do think we've reached peak Trump. And I think with respect to the Epstein files, there is a risk that if that black hole starts to suck him in with enough force, it treats him differently than the other black holes we've seen him sucked into.
I'll somewhat agree with you, Mark, insofar as a signature feature of the MAGA narrative, if you like, is this idea that there is, you know, the Davos-going elite that's self-dealing and takes care of themselves, that don't play by the rules they enforce on others, and Donald Trump is supposed to be against that, right? In other words, he is, what was his line? I am your retribution. So if it can be proven that he is indeed one of them, as opposed to a force against them, then sure, some of that house of cards falls apart. But I'm still with Joe that I'm not sure we're going to or have learned from this anything we didn't already know. And I hadn't added those one and one together and gotten two, Joe, but I think you're right. There is something quite interesting, let's use that adjective, about the timing.
Also, to Mark's point, the thing that got me of you're suing actively to keep from poor people getting money for food, and then in the same day you're telling other people that you're going to maybe, possibly, wink wink, give them $2,000.
Oh, and you're holding a Great Gatsby party down in Florida. I literally do think we've reached peak Trump, different from saying this is the final chapter. But I think some of the veneer off of this false gold that's now all over the White House has people have started to scratch it. And
apparently you can get it at Home Depot. I had no idea.
Right.
Did you know you could get that at Home Depot?
Isn't that emblematic, right? This veneer that we all know, right? If we took those things down and scratched them, they're not, this isn't the sort of stuff that should be hanging in the White House. This isn't really gold, right? But I think Trump, in a way, his image is the same thing. And otherwise you can't explain this whole Ghislaine Maxwell. By the way, I do not think that the 20% of Trump acolytes, who I would call the mega people, I don't think they're up for grabs. Remember, they saw fraud in the election and we can't disprove it. They saw Bigfoot and Trump's always going to be their leader. It doesn't matter. But there is that center, the sort of 20 to 30% of America who aren't racist, who aren't xenophobic, who voted with their economic interest when they voted for Trump and held their nose at the rest. If you make it too hard to hold their nose, particularly around child rape, I think they'll stop.
So there goes that third term.
So this is exactly what so we just got a letter from Dan, who says, I'm sorry, but a panel that wishes away child sexual abuse is horrific, and you should be ashamed for hosting such a morally bankrupt discussion. I do not know where in the world you get the idea that we're wishing away child sexual abuse. All I am saying, the president is so the letter says, I'm disgusted at your panel today. The president is a convicted sex offender and has been credibly accused of many other sexual assaults. Absolutely. I don't think there isn't a person on this panel that disagrees with that. Now, he has also been connected to child sexual abuse. I don't know that is what that connection is. There's a connection to Jeffrey Epstein, mm-hmm. and we know what Jeffrey Epstein was up to, but can you then make that case? I'm not saying it didn't happen at all. I'm just saying you have yet to make that case. The victims deserve justice? Absolutely. That's reason enough to talk about this. Absolutely. And I think we have been talking about it for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And to Mark's excellent point, the people knew all of this. There was nothing about Jeffrey Epstein and the connection between Trump and Jeffrey Epstein that voters did not know on November 1st of 2024, mm-hmm. that they know now on November 12th, 2024.
My point is slightly more subtle. They could have known, but a lot of them actively decided not to know.
That is subtle. That's good. I like it. All right. Let's go to, let's see. I know I had letters. There we go. So Trump and his loyalists can repeat lies when there's nothing there, but Democrats should stop talking until they have something new and Trump issues just get forgotten. Well,
you know what the first rule of holes is, Joe? When you're in one, stop digging.
Yeah, I guess that's probably a good point. I think it is a good point. But I think, so even if you're repeating the truth, if you repeat the truth and people say, okay. Well, then what? I mean, I think that's the problem here, right? I mean, you repeat the truth, and people say, and you say it's the subtle difference is they knew it and they didn't care. And I think that goes back. But I understand Ozzie's point in the letter. I get it. I do. But I don't think that should be misconstrued that we're trying to downplay anything or put that aside. That's not the case. Yes, we all know who Trump is, but the right needs to own up to it, especially the Christian right. That is where the pressure is needed. Some good people, their cover-up shows their true colors. Democrats need to use the story against the Christian right. Well, it hasn't worked so far. And I mean that in the sense that the Christian right has very much endorsed and has pushed and has supported this president, mm-hmm. both as candidate and as leader, right?
Well, I'm loath to even continue to go down this road because I'm not sure what our letter writers want. In other words, is the point that this should be the alpha and omega of how you judge a candidate on their personal conduct? I mean, okay, there are voters who will vote on character issues before party, I suppose. This is just a frustrating conversation, Joe. I'm just not sure what the end game is here.
I'm with the letter writer in the following sense. There are certain must-haves in order to be the president of the United States in my book, not only the ones in the Constitution, right? And I don't believe somebody who tried to subvert the democratic process last time around should be in any elected office. I also don't believe child rapists should be in office. So I'm okay making that a singular qualitative fact as to whether or not the person belongs in political office.
Is there anything you would like to add, Karen?
I keep listening, and I don't see where the concerns of the listeners are coming from. I can only reiterate what you're saying. I think the overall message here is that obviously victims they need to be honored by us pushing for more information, by society pushing for more information. We should get the information. To me, this has been in the news for months and months, and we only get snippets of information here and there. And as you say, every snippet of information is news, but is it really news? Are we really learning anything new? To me, is a system where society on the left and the right demand more information. The information is there. And that not only the administration, but the entire Republican Party has actively worked to prevent the public from getting the information that we've been asking for months. That, to me, is one of the main issues that we're focusing on. It's a deep flaw in our political system.
Let's go to some letters. Let's see, this one from Zachary. Isn't it obvious that the reason neither Democrats nor Republicans have pursued this case when they were in power is that very prominent members of both parties are implicated? So both sides have covered it up to protect their own. Then Lisa says, have any of you read Virginia Giuffre's, I believe is the pronunciation, book? This is the woman who was the victim Prince Andrew, then Prince Andrew, mm-hmm. Now stripped of those titles. She wrote a book prior to her suicide, yeah. And this was published recently. Perhaps you can all read it, then understand why this is an important story and why it must stay in the public conversation. Again, I don't think there's anything, any of us here, who believe that it isn't an important story. But again, even in her story, how does that, and then looking at the investigation into the president's, before he became president, not that that makes a difference, but his activity in this time. And then we go to do two more of these and then we'll go to a break. Alan, how can it be political leverage seeking if the file sat with two administrations? Why can't it just be justice seeking versus protecting the rich? Trump and Clinton both deserve accountability for alleged misconduct. Should it be proven in court? That from Alan. Hard to argue with that.
And well, but I think Alan's letter points out the big gap that we face here, which is if you've ever been part of a criminal trial or sat on a jury, there are a lot of messy stuff that gets revealed. And when the jury's asked a question, it's a very narrow question, usually about a small set of the defendants. The issue with the Epstein files, I presume, is that there are probably hundreds of allegations in them that would, or in an ordinary instance, not be released to the public because nobody's been charged with a crime. But here we have an interesting conundrum, which is we have visible political figures. We've mentioned a few of them in this conversation already who are involved in this. And there's a clamor to say, well, let's just see everything and throw out the normal legal guidelines of, well, if you're not being charged, we're not going to, we don't have to reveal it as part of a trial, we're not going to release it. And I'm all for more clarity rather than less in this case, but I do think sort of where those two filters don't match up is a lot of where the gray area sits in this case.
Well, now that you mention it, there is a compelling argument for not releasing the files, which is that, look, this was a high-profile guy who came in contact with, you know, countless people in business and finance and politics and media over the years. It's very easy for somebody who had nothing to do with his nefarious activities to get kind of caught up in that kind of, you know, that panicked dragnet. So, I guess that's one thing to consider.
In this case, I think the public's interest and the interest of the victims overwhelms our normal reluctance, particularly with respect to publicly visible figures who should understand that their conduct is held to a higher standard, should be held to a higher standard. So I'm okay sort of turning the dial on this one towards more transparency rather than less because of the unique circumstances here.
My default mode is transparency, but I'm merely suggesting that there are it's not an open and shut matter.
We will hold there for a moment. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with the broadcast. We welcome you. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this.
Even when he was standing next to me,
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 12th of November. Moving on, and we go to the headline from the Washington Post this morning. Democrats lose shutdown as Trump and Republicans risk losing the war. We can talk about how we feel about that headline, but more importantly, how we feel about where we are in this currently. We touched on it a bit ago. Democrats are embroiled in a new round of infighting, while Republicans are bracing for longer-term consequences if they continue to oppose an extension of Obamacare subsidies. The votes by a handful of Democratic senators this week to end a government shutdown without key concessions from Republicans have left the party bruised and divided, struggling to explain to a furious base why they folded without securing the health care subsidies they called essential. For many, this was a head-scratching defeat just days after election triumphs showed voters were on their side. But the closing chapter to the more than 40-day standoff and the underlying fight over extending tax credits under the Affordable Care Act could prove perilous for Republicans in the long term. President Donald Trump's own pollsters and allies have warned that not extending the health care subsidies would amount to a major political risk in the midterms, and the public has shown it will blame a shutdown on the party in power, making any future breakdowns risky for Republicans. The result? The longest government shutdown in U.S. history has no clear ultimate political victor as the House prepares to vote later today on the deal to reopen. Polling shows the public disapproves of both parties' approach. Democrats are bearing the brunt of the political losses in the immediate term, while Republicans are bracing for longer-term consequences. Karen.
Yeah, I find this discussion fascinating, right? It's like who's gaining more from the situation and from the end of the shutdown? Are Republicans actually going to be hurt more in the long run? Trump during the shutdown bulldozed the East Wing. We saw the continued impact of tariffs, the impact on air travel, the impact the shutdown has on businesses, and the deep cruelty when he, and we mentioned it before, proactively went out to prevent states from providing SNAP benefits to the most vulnerable sectors of society, and voters really hated this, and that was very clear, and Trump didn't seem to care. So I'm really wondering, and I'd like to hear my colleagues on the panel's viewpoints, because I don't think the Democrats were really in a position to succeed at securing the continuation of the health care subsidies. And that, of course, it's tragic, because not only, again, people will see an increase of 2 to 3 times of the current cost for healthcare. And that, of course, means that a lot of people will not sign on to healthcare, and they'll be not just under insured, but uninsured. And we have to keep in mind that it's us, the society, who will ultimately pay for the cost of it. The average healthcare cost for an American is $14,000 a year. The average in other wealthy countries is $7,000. And that comes from a deeply flawed healthcare system. So this is an ongoing debate, of course. But I'm not sure whether Democrats. Do you think that the Democrats actually stood a chance of protecting the subsidies that they're fighting for?
Well, that's to your point, right, Mark? And I mean, they shouldn't have. You don't believe they should have closed in the first place?
Look, I never thought the Democrats had a realistic path to success here. They were going to take the U.S. hostage and threaten the Republicans, but there's only one problem: they care more about the hostage than those they were threatening with the hostage. Donald Trump knew he was going to hold out for as long as it took, and he knew that the Republicans would fear him more than the indirect consequences that resulted from any shutdown. So to me, this was a flawed strategy from the beginning. I said that Schumer should have done what he did in March, which was not try to shut the government down. You know, it is interesting to me, Joe, that the Democrats and the ally that voted for their continuing resolution to effectively open the government aren't up for re-election. A few of them are leaving Congress. This feels a little bit orchestrated to me, a bit of, you know, theater dressed up as governance. Now everyone on the left, except those who voted for to end the shutdown, can feign outrage, grab a clip for their highlight reel, and we get to move on. You know, Schumer's leadership has never been solid. I mean, in his best days, right, he was sort of a lame Robin to Nancy Pelosi's Batman, right? But a lame Robin on his own, we've seen this whole incident shows you what Schumer is as a leader on its own, and it's a pretty sad state of affairs. Frankly, I don't think he was going to last. This is a man who's been in the Senate since 1982, if I'm right. I don't think he was going to last long past the midterms. Anyway, I think this has just sealed that fate. But the Democrats, their message never really landed. Sure, the polls blame the Republicans more, but the Democrats couldn't explain effectively what the fight was even about. Yeah, I think that's difficult. And it's also difficult to be in a position where you as the Democrats, whoever the shutdown party is, always has to say, you're forcing me to shut down the government because you won't give me what I want, so it's your fault. That's always a bit of a twisted argument. It is sad to me that I fear that TSA and check-in lines and the threat of them lengthening resonated more with public and politician than food bank lines, but it looks like that's what happened. You know, progressives as a part of this whole thing didn't help much because their message was, I just want to throw sand in the gears of government and stop the Donald Trump wrecking ball in its tracks. And so the message got away. During the midst of this, though, Donald Trump, as I mentioned earlier, hands the Democrats a gift. I mean, literally, again, let's just think through this. The president of the United States effectively sued not to use money to feed the most vulnerable in our country. And if you look at his popularity ratings, they degraded significantly once he started that. So the Democrats, and they had the wind at their back during the last election and the results. I mean, they scored a 10 out of 10 on their midterm quiz, frankly. Or not midterm, but mid-semester quiz. But nonetheless, they folded. It was because their political aspirations outstripped their ability to strategize politically. Nancy Pelosi used to keep that together for them. And in her absence, they outran their coverage, and here we are with the screaming match. I don't think it'll matter much in the long run. I think by the midterms, this will all be forgotten. And I do think the Republicans are a bit boxed in now on healthcare costs. And I do think we've probably reached peak Trump, given his actions during the whole shutdown.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear from Robert and his opinion, and then we welcome yours as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this and news with David Gustina.
Faith is a wall I must climb. I was intrigued by your spirit.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about the end of the shutdown that is expected by the end of today, as Congress is expected to vote as congressional representatives make their way back to Washington, which has further been complicated by the fact that flights aren't exactly running on time. So people are trying to get back, and hopefully they'll have enough of them by this afternoon to vote, or at least the hope of the House leadership. So we look at that story this morning. We've heard from Mark Whitman, investment banker on Wall Street, and Karen Riedel, associate professor of government at Dutchess County Community College, and now we hear from Robert Pendicio, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
Oh, boy. So much to say. I'll try to be economical. I mean, first, Joe, the idea that this is going to be any kind of exercise in tea leaf reading to tell us how the midterms are going to go, I think is vaguely comical. It's a long way off, and this probably won't even be the last shutdown, right? Before, between now and the midterms, there's another.
I mean, right now, January 30th looks like.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, what we need to do, I've said this before, but I think we need to just start taping these shows. Make them as generic as possible, and then just run them again, and we'll take a couple days off.
Yeah, sure. So the midterms are a long way off, and I'm not sure what the over under is on more shutdowns, but if it's one, I'll take the over. At the risk of relitigating this, the Democrats had a pretty weak hand to begin with. I wish the Republicans were a little bit better in their messaging here. Am I wrong to say that the Obamacare, the ACA, was supposed to lower healthcare costs, but here we are looking to yet extend subsidies yet again? At what point does that just become permanent? And at what point do the Republicans who were saying, look, this is not doing anything to reduce costs, do we have to concede that they have a point at some point? But the larger, to me, more interesting political ramification of this is, look, whether you admire or don't admire Donald Trump, you almost have to admire his animal cunning in the way this has been played. You take an extended shutdown, and Mark, sure, you can frame this as what was your phrase, shooting the hostages or some such. But here is a week after the Democrats had a terrific week. Now suddenly he's managed to ignite a civil war within the Democratic Party. Again, whether you admire him or do not admire him, you have to kind of be a little bit in awe of that raw animal cunning and that political brinksmanship.
Do you see? I mean, go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize too that. Robert, you're right. We're going to see more shutdowns. The next one, the next debate will be leading up to January 30th, just a few weeks around the corner. But it's become normal that our government is unable or unwilling to do its most basic function,
yeah.
And that is to determine where our money is spent.
Yeah.
There is no other wealthy country in the world where this happens. Germany, I can't remember, it's maybe a year or two ago, we weren't able to pass the budget. It seemed like a crisis, but it really wasn't, because there the system is simply, we're going to continue with the previous budget until we actually pass the budget. In the UK, if the government is not able to pass a budget, that it will call a vote of confidence, and most likely elections will be called. There is no other wealthy country where this happens, and it happens, the discussion on the budget, the feeling of a crisis or a crisis happens every single year here in the United States. So I think it is a deeper question of, we have the answers for that, why our system is flawed, but it's deeply, deeply flawed. And when the government cannot pass a budget, then it's not doing its basic work.
Yeah, I'm going to strain my neck nodding in vigorous agreement with you, Karen, because the real loser here, as usual, is public confidence in governance. Both parties have made shutdowns part of their toolkit, let's be honest. And that is corrosive to public trust. Sure, in this round, the Democrats absorb the bigger political bruise. Their base is angry. Their moderates are nervous. They've got nothing tangible to show for the disruption. But at the end of the day, the big loser here is public confidence in this entire charade.
Yeah, and charade seems like the right word, doesn't it? I mean...
Yes, well, there's a lot of political theater. Robert, on the Americans with Healthcare Act, I want to say one thing, which is when that was initially put in place, a lot of its proponents wanted everything to be nationalized. The compromise was a private system. The intent was nobody ever thought that – I don't think anyone ever thought that healthcare would defy inflation and actually deflate. I think the objective was to broaden coverage, provide an economic safety net for people who didn't have jobs or switched jobs or had pre-existing conditions. I think that if you talk to the people who put that in place at the time, they knew that the pool they were erecting inside of the American with Healthcare Act needed a lot more subsidization than they were getting, and they planned to leg it in. So to say that this is – I think there was a little bit of a muddle, and again, this goes back to the Democratic message when they said, oh, well, this is a carryover from – the COVID era was an excuse to put in another leg of layer of subsidy
right.
that this program needs. Now, we can all decide whether or not we like this, but I think the origins of it are a little bit different. I do think that the Democrats, in the end, come out okay. Again, because of the political theater going on, everybody gets to claim that they could have gotten this mysteriously better deal than the eight or so who settled on reopening the government actually got. I think you know, Chuck Schumer was dead in the water as a leader anyway. And I think it's okay that the party out of power is still trying to find itself. It doesn't typically find itself in full until it nominates a presidential candidate. And it's better they wait to do that until later than now anyway, as circumstances will change. I do think in the absence of Nancy Pelosi, it's a really messy process. And you see ideals get out ahead of political strategy. And this is a prime example of it.
Yeah. You know, one interesting after effect of this could be that we have a more serious national conversation about health care costs, which I would welcome. And Mark, look, I'm not expert on insurance or health care, but I compare this to the national conversation we're also not having about college costs, for example. I work in education. So when you have a system that the deep-pocketed becomes the lender of last resort. Like, in other words, compare this to loan forgiveness, which I always correct people say, it's not loan forgiveness, it is debt reassignment. Someone's paying, and the problem is it's not the colleges, right? So they have no incentive to lower the costs. So that's when I was referring to the Republican messaging around this. That's the conversation I want to have, is how do you lower costs? And I suspect it, and I know we're talking about the shutdown, not the ACA, but I don't see a scenario under which healthcare costs come down as long as we continue these subsidies.
I'm going with you on changing the subject just slightly, but on the loan forgiveness though, I mean,
debt reassignment,
whatever you want to call it. But let me ask you this:
sure.
For the students and for the people who owed the money, who were promised one thing, and then it became another.
Oh yeah,
I mean that is where this.
Oh, I'm,
I don't have any. I don't. I, so there's the issue, mm-hmm. and so I'm willing to go back and forth on that. Debt reassignment, absolutely, got it. What about those people who you said, oh, you didn't have to worry about it. Don't, you're good. You're, everything's fine.
Let me
kidding.
Be clear. I am not interested in saying to students who took out massive loans for worthless degrees, sucks to be you, kid. I have no interest in saying that whatsoever. But my point is, if you are a university, you have no incentive to rein in your costs as long as someone else is paying.
All right. Let's go to the numerous letters that we have on this very subject.
Now, what did we do wrong, Joe?
Yes. And when I say this very subject, I talk about the shutdown. Good morning, says Kevin. The end of the shutdown and the Democrats' actions during it may very well be the definition of a tactical loss followed by a strategic victory in the midterms if the Democrats can work together. And present a cohesive argument to the American people next fall. This just may be a winning hand in the long run. Time will tell. Well, you know, this is the woes of the Democrats of working together, right? I mean, they don't have the best reputation in that regard, but some would say that most political parties don't.
Scorpions in a bottle.
Yeah, but we've also pointed out that this blind need to follow Trump, and if you're a Republican, it probably was the case that you had to stay in line because Trump's ire was worse than the fallout from the shutdown. But there is the risk here that Trump leads these characters, you know, off a cliff they can't recover from if the Democrats get themselves in order. And it is pretty clear, you know, that Trump is in many ways is. He's either lost the pulse of the Americans, or he's decided that because he can't make good on all his promises, he's got to turn his attention and hopefully the nation's elsewhere. And the Democrats in this election cycle did just what they should, was go back to the affordability issue. I don't think the Democrats are as fractured as many think, because if you look at New York City or you look at New Jersey, they're just different versions of the same message that were in many ways tailored to the voting populace in those markets.
Back to the letters for this morning. We go to Fred. All this analysis about how the two parties will or will not be affected in the midterms and about how Trump may be a drag on the party, it all assumes we will have free and fair elections. I have no confidence that will happen, and I'm quite sure that planning is well underway for various ways to disrupt and invalidate the elections. I do not think Fred is alone in that particular view. Janet writes, the millionaire-billionaire tax cuts also were supposed to be temporary, and the Republicans found the will to make those permanent, so why not the health exchange subsidies? Loss of health care subsidies will increase premiums for all plans, not only the ones currently being subsidized. Also, we go to Joe, who writes, a strategic overhaul is crucial for the Democratic Party. They must adapt to current political realities with a united and clear message to ensure future effectiveness, begin with removing Chuck Schumer. Wenda writes to us and says, if you're sure you can't win, you just give in. We wouldn't even be a country if everyone felt that way. Quote, forget it. It's revolutionary soldiers. You just can't win. That's Linda's viewpoint on this. We go to William. If in December both House and Senate approve extension of the health care subsidies, won't Trump just veto the bill? So what's the strategy there? Good question. All right. Greg.
The extension would be part of the continuing resolution, right? So in other words, you can't veto just one aspect of it. You either swallow it whole or not at all, right?
You can pass me what you're smoking. I mean, we know that the subsidies aren't going to be attached to any bill under the current Congress, and they're not getting and whatever they were attached to isn't getting by the president, so I'm not worrying about
We're referring to the promise that was made to have an up or down vote on this as part of the deal. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, but a promise, by the way, only in the Senate, which last time I checked, you need two houses of Congress for a bill to pass.
There are more ACA clients in red states than in blue states. If I had an ACA policy and lived in a red state, writes Greg, why would I ever vote for a Republican candidate? I would have to be ignorant. Then we go, have we exhausted the batch of letters that I had before me? I believe we have. All right. Anybody else want to say anything before we move on the subject? Going once?
Not I.
Going twice. All right. Here we go to a new, going on to a new subject. No matter what happens today and in the House of Representatives in regards to the shutdown, and we assume the reopening of government, as a fifth day of flight disruptions played out yesterday, airlines cautioned that it will take time for travel schedules to snap back, even if the agreement to reopen the federal government does go the distance. A Senate bill to end the shutdown is expected to be taken up by the House on Wednesday. But should lawmakers fail to move quickly, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy warned Tuesday, there will be serious consequences for air travel. If the House doesn't pass this bill, you're going to look at Saturday, Sunday, and Monday as tiddlywinks. I don't know exactly what that means from Sean Duffy, but I like saying tiddlywinks. It's referring to a three-day span that saw nearly 7,000 flight cancellations and more than 28,000 delays. It's going to get much worse than that. Last week, the FAA ordered airlines to reduce their schedules at 40 major U.S. airports, beginning with a 4% rollback Friday. The head of the agency, Brian Bedford, said the reductions were necessary to reduce the strain on the aviation system as controllers and other frontline federal workers continue to work without pay during the shutdown, now the longest in history. This again from the Washington Post.
Robert.
See my phone here, Joe?
Yes.
You know what that is? That is the directions on my iPhone for how long it will take me to drive from here to New Orleans, Louisiana, and it's 20 hours and 59 minutes. So I'm scheduled to fly to New Orleans and then Houston next week, so I'm watching this like a hawk because I would prefer not to have to get in my car for 24 hours on Monday. Yeah, look, what else is there to say? This is another one of those things. Okay, it's not like SNAP benefits that affect, you know, one out of eight Americans. But this one affects Americans who vote, right, who have the ear of politicians and who are nervous about travel plans coming up for Thanksgiving, which is what, the busiest travel day of the year. So I don't think it's a coincidence that this has become a prime talking point for ending the shutdown, because this is one of those things that is profoundly disruptive to folks.
Mark.
Joe, I said it earlier. I fear that we've responded more to TSA and check-in lines than we did to lines at food banks. I don't really know what that says about us. It's not probably a good thing.
Karen.
Yeah, I agree with both Mark and Robert on the assessment. And it's when you slow something down or you stop a service, then it takes a while to reinstate it. And I personally would err on the side of worrying. I do worry about air travel, not only because I want people to get around, and I know how miserable it is to be stuck at the airport and having one flight after the other canceled, but also because of the impact it has on especially smaller businesses right now. But I am more concerned about reinstating SNAP and how long it takes for the 3 million New Yorkers, for example, who depend on SNAP each month when they're going to get the support.
And that's a great point, too, because as sort of the right hand's doing its thing, the left hand's doing its thing, yesterday it came to the Supreme Court extending the order allowing limits on food stamp payments. So you have this ruling that's going on while the government's trying to get its act back together. But as of now, the justices have allowed the Trump administration to withhold full benefits for two more days while Congress worked to advance a government funding bill.
Well, you're bearing the lead. That order was signed by who? Ketanji Brown Jackson.
No, actually not.
No.
Well, that initial order was the Supreme Court extended it on Tuesday, and actually Ketanji Brown Jackson was the dissent. On Friday evening, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, one of the court's three liberals, had temporarily granted an emergency request by the Trump administration to block a lower court judge's order that the government fund the anti-hunger program during the shutdown. Justice Jackson, who has written critically of many Trump administration policies, handled the emergency request because she is assigned to applications from the region of the country where the case originated. After Justice Jackson granted the temporary pause, she set a speedy briefing schedule in the food stamp case, but the Trump administration and the challenges had laid out their cases to justices by early Tuesday. But she did write the dissent in this particular case that came out yesterday, to my understanding. All right. Anyone else on that? Karen?
The emergency requests that are coming to the Supreme Court and that are granted by the Supreme Court from this administration are extraordinary. I just looked up, I know that the Trump administration relies on them heavily. I just looked up the data. It's Donald Trump used these emergency requests more frequent in the first 20 weeks of his second term compared to Biden's administration for 4 years. These emergency requests are problematic, of course, because the justices do not hear the cases. They don't hear arguments on both sides. They seem to be very keen on just granting them because they're short term. They don't have to tell us about the vote who voted for it. They don't have to give us an explanation, a justification. So whenever I hear about emergency requests. I'm deeply troubled again by the system that we have in place.
So maybe after the construction crews are done with the ballroom, they can install a drive-in window at the Supreme Court.
Diane says airline shutdown, more a middle class issue. No staff stamp recipient is traveling for the holidays. Then we go to Patrick. You guys are pitiful. The shutdown drew the nation's attention to more than ACA health care. It gave the Democrats in the Senate the platform to also discuss affordability snap cuts, health care costs in general, and Republican mean-spiritedness as they cut $4 trillion in taxes for the super wealthy and mega corporations as they meanwhile cut $2 trillion for health benefits from the working class, poor, and retired people. The result of the Senate discussions leading up to the November vote were victories in Virginia, New Jersey, and California. The struggle will continue in January after we let the people have a Thanksgiving and a Christmas holiday, thus avoiding the Democrats playing the Grinch at year-end, another victory.
I would say that letter writer is not gainsaying my point, but amplifying it.
Well, I would pump the brakes on the effect on the election. There may have been a few Virginia House of Delegates seats that were swayed by this, but I think the results we saw were largely what we were going to see, whether or not there was a shutdown, frankly.
Yes, I think you're right, or I agree with
you. The margins, I think, were larger than a lot of us expected, but I don't disagree with you at all.
All right, let's go to Barbara. People who can afford to fly, people who cannot even afford food. I'm much more concerned about the latter. And also, the priority of airlines over feeding the poor is more of an example of whose voices are heard loudest at this time. Those voices who hold power are not the poor, and that is why the food shortages affecting the poor was what was not a public priority. It was a priority to those who are least represented, the poor. That from Anonymous. All right. Anybody else on that? If not, I will move to our final.
I just want to make one quick remark, which is, and I think we talked about this last time, Joe, a shocking number of Americans, 1 out of 8, get SNAP, Supplementary Nutritional Assistance, or so-called food stamps. So the idea that there's, without question, there's, flyers are a lot more affluent than SNAP recipients, but there's some overlap there.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left. Let's go to Venezuela orders massive mobilization as U.S. aircraft carrier approaches. This from the Washington Post. The USS Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier has entered waters near Latin America, prompting Venezuela to put the entire country's military arsenal at the ready. As the U.S. naval buildup fuels speculation that the Trump administration intends to dramatically escalate its deadly counter-narcotics campaign there, the Ford and its three accompanying warships arrived in the region Tuesday, the Navy said in a news release. The ships were not yet in the Caribbean Sea, but had crossed into the U.S. Southern Command's jurisdiction, a vast area that includes part of the Atlantic Ocean and drug smuggling routes in the Pacific used by cartels based in Colombia and neighboring Ecuador. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said in a statement, these forces will enhance and augment existing capabilities to disrupt narcotics trafficking and degrade and dismantle transnational criminal organizations. The development, though forecast weeks ago, appeared certain to deepen the sense of unease felt in some corners of Congress since President Trump began to ruminate about a potential regime change in Venezuela. Mark.
Oh, here we go again, right? I mean, if the administration thinks removing Maduro is going to automatically solve the problem, they need to think again. History shows that the guys with the guns step into the vacuum. Look at Afghanistan. Look at Libya. Now Rubio's behind calling the shots. This is his version of America first empire management. I guess he finally gets to be Secretary of State on this one. They've done it with a bad sleight of hand. They've basically tried to turn drug interdiction procedures into a war by calling it narco-terrorism, therefore avoiding all the legal restraints that should be placed on the administration if they really do want to use the military. The kicker here is that we've let Chevron already back into Venezuela. They're cracking oil while we get ready for a potential conflict. And look, Latin America's got the receipts about how this doesn't work well, whether it be Guatemala, Chile, Nicaragua, Panama. I mean, it's literally a century, and we've seen this movie before. You topple the strong man, and we hate the sequel even worse. You know, let's call it what it is. It's just sort of regime change theater. Big openers, bad endings, and America never gets a refund.
Karen.
I'm reiterating what Mark is saying is that I'm trying to understand what the actual objective is, because it certainly isn't a war on drugs. We get from Venezuela cocaine. Cocaine's not the problem in the United States. I genuinely doubt that democratization is the real objective here either. And yes, there is oil there, and yes, the Venezuela is aligned with our adversaries, Russia, China, Iran. But given, as Mark says, you know, history has shown regime change doesn't work well for us. And Venezuela has numerous factors that will make it particularly hard to achieve a real change, right? Given the regime's deep roots in the military, security services, paramilitaries, it'll be a very difficult undertaking if that's what the administration wants to do. So I'm not really sure what the objectives are, and I have the feeling that to a certain degree, it is just once again showing our military muscle, and this is something that his administration, both Trump and Hexas in particular, are very keen on doing, to show our military might and rely on the military might to achieve objectives abroad, and it just hasn't worked out well for us. So we'll see what the actual. I'd like to hear other people's perspectives on what the actual objectives here are. It certainly are not the ones that are given by the administration.
Yeah, I think those cautions are well put. Regime change is a challenging game to play right, if at all. But that said, I don't necessarily agree that this is, you know, capricious or reckless use of force. And come on, Maduro's not a good guy. There is a compelling national interest in stopping the flow of drugs and dismantling the cartel networks. I'm not blithe about that. They are fueling violence, addiction, instability here at home. But there's a right way to do it. You know, clear objectives, congressional authorization, a strategy that brings the American people along. So the risk here is that this looks like kind of like a cowboy use of the military as opposed to, you know, following proper procedures.
First of all, you can't bomb the demand side of this equation. That's addiction. So that doesn't work. The problem is fentanyl in terms of lethality in the United States, not cocaine. So we're not anywhere near that one. And if you want to do this right, you need to make sure that the guys with guns aren't the ones sitting ready to fill the void when you create a void. And we're far from that. There hasn't been any reasonable planning down there. This is just, I don't know what they're planning, but it looks really dangerous to me.
We are out of time. I want to thank all the folks who wrote to us, and also thank our wonderful panelists for joining us this morning. Robert, Karen, Mark, thank you. You're wonderful. I appreciate it. Good to have you here.
Thanks,
Joe. We will be back in just a moment with this week's book picks right after this.